chapter 24, where the sovereignty of God is actually one of the themes of our passage this morning. 2 Samuel chapter 24. The title I've given to this passage of Scripture is Sinful Census, Sovereign God. This passage poses one of the most difficult theological issues in all the Bible, and that is God's relationship to sin and to evil. And so we will attempt to explore this together this morning. I'd like to read for you 2 Samuel chapter 24, the first 10 verses. Now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, "Go number Israel and Judah." The king said to Joab, the commander of the army who is with him, "Go about now through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, and register the people that I may know the number of the people." But Joab said to the king, "Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?" Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army. So Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to register the people of Israel. They crossed the Jordan and camped in Aroer on the right side of the city that is in the middle of the valley of Gad toward Jazer. Then they came to Gilead and to the land of Tatimhodshi, and they came to Danjon and around to Sidon, and came to the fortress of Tyre and to all the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites, and they went out to the south of Judah to Beersheba. Basically what they're doing is they're moving in a great counterclockwise movement around the land, collecting all the numbers for the census. Verse 8, "So when they had gone about through the whole land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. And Joab gave the number of the registration of the people to the king. And there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000 men. Now David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, 'I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have acted very foolishly.'" Now, what's going to happen after this is that God is going to send the prophet Gad, and he's going to punish Israel because of this census. And he's basically going to give David the opportunity to choose one of three judgments to fall upon the land. And a very severe judgment will fall upon the land. They'll eventually make atonement, and the wrath of God will stop. But all of this is initiated by David wanting to make a census, which turned out to be sin. Okay, let's look at this passage. Let's define the problem first off. Letter A, David's census was sin. Now, when you look at this in verse 3, you already get the sense of this when Joab begins to ask King David, "Why does my lord the king delight in this thing? Why are you wanting to do this?" So David is wanting basically to number the people, and he's wanting to number them in verse 9, basically to find out the size of his army. And Joab is kind of wondering, "Why do you want to do this?" So Joab already suspects and does not understand why in the world David would want to do this thing. And then down in verse 10, later on, David finally does realize what I have done is sinful. So he clearly acknowledges that numbering the people was actually a sin. Now in letter A, under number 2, what was sinful about what he did? A census in and of itself is not sinful. There are times when God tells his leaders to number the people. And I've given to you several examples in the book of Numbers where God tells Moses to take a census of the people. So a census of the people is not in and of itself a sin. So what was David's sin in ordering the census? Well, there are many different suggestions because the text really does not tell us that. But commentators have suggested that possibly the sinful part of this is that David did not require all the people that were numbered to pay a half shekel tax to the temple. This in Exodus chapter 30 was required that if you took a census of the people, then all the people that are being numbered will have to pay a half shekel fine or a tax to support the work of the temple. And possibly David did not do that. Now, this is a suggestion that may or may not have any significance. We do know, however, that at other times in David's life, he failed to follow the guidelines of the Torah. For example, when they were carrying the Ark of the Covenant, you remember? And Uzzah, you know, when they were carrying it on the cart and it started to topple and fall over, that Uzzah reached out and tried to stabilize it and God struck him dead. All of that was because David did not follow the requirements of the Torah that you were to carry the ark on your shoulders with poles. You're not to carry it on a cart drawn by oxen. So people have argued that possibly David overlooked the Torah and how to carry out the census. I think probably a better answer to the sin issue was the fact that David desired to boast in the size of his army. He wanted to number, find out how many soldiers he had, men over 20, so that he could probably boast to the nations at the size and the abundance of his fighting machine. In 1 John chapter 2, verse 16, this is called the boastful pride of life. And maybe at this point in time, David was trusting more in the size of his army and thinking that his power rested in that rather than in God. And maybe that was the sin behind the census. Again, we really don't know for sure. But what we do know is that ultimately in verse 1, God is angry at Israel. And in order to bring about this judgment, God's anger incites David so that David's sin basically opens the floodgates, but the actual flood is due to the sin of Israel. So in verse 1, it's kind of an interesting thing here, and I don't fully understand how this is working out, but it says, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it, that is God's anger, incited David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. So God is using David's sin to somewhat be the introduction of God's wrath upon the nation because of their sin, maybe idolatry, or whatever was going on within the nation. But clearly, David's census was sin. That's letter A. And letter B, clearly David's census was incited by God in verse 1. Notice again that the anger of the Lord incited David against them, that is against Israel, to say, go number Israel and Judah. That's what David did, and that was sin. So it was a sin, and that was the result of God inciting David to do something. And what he did was sin. Now, this raises all kinds of questions in our minds. So did God personally make David sin? Does this make God the immediate author of sin? See, it raises these kinds of questions because we know that what David did in making the census was sin. But we also clearly know that he was incited to do that by the anger of God. So does that make God the ultimate author of sin? Well, Roman numeral 2, let's now deliberate on this problem. Let's think about it, see what we can come up with as some ways to biblically think about this issue. Letter A, first off, there are two truths that we must affirm without compromise. Number one, that God is holy and completely righteous. God cannot sin. He can't do anything that's sinful. He's always holy and righteous. He's light. There is no darkness within him. He can't even look upon sin, Habakkuk 1:13. So God is holy. That's a truth. We cannot compromise that at all. So we can never say that God sinned. Never, ever. God is holy. He cannot sin. But number two, God is also sovereign over all things. Yahweh is the Lord over the universe. He exercises his dominion over all powers and authorities, and he uses his creatures to accomplish his holy will. God is sovereign over all things. Now, God's sovereignty or his control extends to all events. In Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11, it says he works all things after the counsel of his will. All things. God works all things after the counsel of his will. And I've given you a list of some of the things that are included within God's sovereign control. First, you have the good actions of men. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10 says that our good works have been prepared ahead of time by God for us to walk in. So all of your good works, you can't pat yourself on the back for them. God predestined that you would do them. God gets the glory, not us. The evil actions of men are ultimately also included in God's sovereign control. In Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4, both of those passages deal with the evil actions that Judas and Pontius Pilate and Herod and all the other people did in crucifying Jesus Christ. The greatest sinful act of all of history, it clearly says in those passages, was predetermined by God and predestined according to whatever God's hand chose to come to pass. So God was sovereign. God predestined the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, and that had to include the sinful actions of those men. You read the passages, it's very clear. You cannot escape it. In Luke chapter 22, verse 22, it speaks of what Judas did as being ordained of God. In Proverbs 16, verse 4, it says that God has created all things for its own purpose, even the wicked for the day of judgment. So God, again, is sovereign over evil men. In Revelation chapter 17, verse 17, it speaks of those 10 horns that God put it into their hearts to unify with a common purpose and attack the Babylon, the lady, the harlot. But God put it into their hearts to have a common purpose to do that. So God was sovereign over all of that. In Exodus chapter 4, verse 21, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And the reason why Pharaoh did not give in to the first plague or the second plague or the third plague, because God hardened his heart. God was sovereign over that. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 11, says that God will send a deluding influence upon them that they might believe what was false. God is sovereign over that. Next, he's also sovereign over the evil actions of evil spirits. In 1 Kings chapter 22, you remember, God is talking in heaven, and King Ahab has sinned, and God is going to bring judgment upon Ahab. And so God is talking in heaven, and he says, who will go up and entice Ahab to fall in battle? And one of the spirits comes up to him and says, I will entice Ahab. And God says, how will you do that? And he says, I will become a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all of his prophets. And God says, go and prevail. Go entice him and accomplish it. God was sovereign over that. And that was probably not a holy angel that did that, but it's probably some demon. So that God is using that to accomplish his holy purpose. Job chapter 1, chapter 2, God says to Satan, Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Who initiates all that trial? Who puts the boundaries of it? It's God. God is sovereign over Satan. See, the problem that we have is that we elevate Satan way higher than he should be, and we demote God way below where he should be, till basically they're on the same level. Satan is an angel. He's a creature. And creatures just can't compare with the Creator. The Creator is sovereign over all of his creatures, and that includes the devil as well. God is also sovereign over incidental events. Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. You know, you're playing a game at home and you roll dice, you know, maybe it's a board game. I say that rather than gambling in Las Vegas, but you're rolling dice, you know, who controls those things? Ultimately is God. Matthew chapter 10 talks about, you know, God knowing when little birds fall to the ground. In 1 Kings 22, verse 34, when that archer pulled back his bow and he shot at random, and that arrow came and found that unprotected little area in Ahab's armor and struck him and ultimately led to his death. An arrow shot at random, God controlled that and guided it to ultimately bring about the death of Ahab. God is sovereign over even what we would say actions of chance or luck. God is sovereign over them. The duration of your life. Our days are numbered by God. You will die on the day that God has predetermined for you to die. And until that day, nothing can kill you. Isn't that wonderful? Now, if we only knew the day we're going to die. But God knows. God has determined that. And until that day, we are invincible. And we will accomplish God's purpose for our life. The weather is controlled by Him. God hurled the mighty wind that brought the storm on Jonah in the boat. Suffering and affliction is ordained by God. 1 Thessalonians 3, verse 3, the Apostle Paul talks about the afflictions that were ordained for me to endure. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6, Peter reminds his readers that if necessary, you will go through various trials, because there's a divine necessity that we go through certain trials in our life. Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, Joseph tells his brothers, you know, all that you did to me, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. God meant it. In other words, God purposed it. God controlled it. God brought about the circumstances for good. So God is controlled sovereignly, has control over our suffering and our afflictions. And that in and of itself ought to give you great confidence in your day of trial. The means as well as the ends are ordained by God. He doesn't just ordain the outcome. He ordains the means also that lead up to the outcome as well. So those are the two truths that we do not compromise on. God is holy. He's completely righteous. Can never be anything but holy. But He's also sovereign over all things. Another thing that we should think about in working through this problem of God inciting David to do something that ultimately became sin is to realize, letter B, that God uses secondary causes. How can God be sovereign over sin and evil and not be the immediate author of sin? How can God incite David to do something which clearly was sin without God being the author of sin? Well, the answer to that, and I'm not saying that we can fully understand all of this. I don't fully understand it. But part of the biblical answer to understand this whole issue, of course, one of them is that God can do whatever He wants to and still be holy, but is that God uses secondary causes. God is the primary cause of all things. But under this, there are also secondary causes. Let's take an example. Maybe this will clarify. When God delivered Israel out of Egypt, and they make their way to the Red Sea, and they're hemmed in by mountains on one side, water on this side, and here comes the Egyptian army to cut off any retreat, any way of escape, and they are trapped like a rat right up against the sea. And what God did is He divided the Red Sea, a miracle of God. Well, the text says, what is it that caused the waters to divide? A strong east wind. So when you say what caused the waters to divide, one way you can answer that is by saying the strong east wind did it. But who sent the strong east wind? God did. So God was the primary cause. The strong east wind was the secondary cause. Or to put it another way, God was the ultimate cause, the wind was the immediate cause. Now what that does is, that enables God to be untainted by sin and yet to still have sovereign control over all things. Now, everything that happens, happens according to God's sovereign decrees. But God does not cause evil in the same way that He causes good. God is not the immediate